CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening, Ayesha Chaudhry, Assistant Professor of Islamic and Gender Studies in the Department of Classical, Near Eastern, and Religious Studies, and also a member of the Institute for Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice. Additionally, she's also the author of a new book entitled Domestic Violence and the Islamic Tradition. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure to see you here. So I want to begin with how you became interested in the general area of Islamic studies and gender. It seems to me the two fields don't immediately suggest connections.
Okay, thank you. That's a great question. I became interested in this topic because I grew up in Toronto. So it's a personal journey. I grew up in Toronto. I was born and raised there. I was raised by very conservative Muslim parents. And I tried to balance these sometimes conflicting identities. And when I was in grade 9, I went to a mosque for Friday prayer. And while I was there, I encountered, I went to the bookstore afterward, and there was a Quran there. There was like a, they were selling, you know, tons of books, and they also had these Qurans there. And there was a particularly beautiful copy of the Quran. The words that came to mind to me at that time in ninth grade were, it was very cute and adorable. It had gold leafing on the edges. It looked really pretty. And it was the size of my hand, so it was, you know, it was cute. So I bought it, and I started reading the Quran from the beginning, and from beginning to end. And the thing is, Muslims actually grow up, when we grow up, we are taught to read the Quran when we're fairly young. So I actually learned to read the Quran in Arabic when I was 5 years old. So I had read the Quran many times already, but in Arabic, and I don't speak Arabic, so I didn't know what I was reading. So this was my first time reading the Quran in English. And when I was reading the Quran, I came upon chapter 4, verse 34. And the verse seemed to suggest that, it seemed to suggest, the translation suggested that God was prescribing husbands to hit their wives if they were disobedient. And this verse really bothered me.
And this is at 9 years old.
This is in ninth grade.
Ninth grade.
So, and it really bothered me. And the reason it bothered me, shamefully, was not because I was worried about Muslim women, but because I was worried about how this made Muslims look to non-Muslims. You know, Jews and Christians were going to see this verse, and they were going to be like, oh my God, these Muslims are so crazy. They say it's okay to hit your wife. And I knew that was not, I knew that wasn't true, because the way that I was raised with Islam, I did not believe that to be true. So I felt like there was something was wrong with this translation. It was making us look bad, and I wanted more clarification. And so I started asking Muslim scholars about this verse, so local imams, and they would sort of, instead of being like, oh, yeah, that's a mistake in the translation or that's wrong, they were like, oh, it's not as bad as you think it is, actually. You know, your husbands can hit their wives, but only like very lightly, and they can't leave a bruise or they can't leave a mark. And they started, you know, offering me these reasons for why this verse was okay that really troubled me. And so as I grew up in the community, I started also encountering situations where women would complain to the imam about their husbands hitting them. And they would say things like, you know, I was raised at, like, they would say things like, my husband hit me. Is it true that there's a verse in the Quran that says that he can hit me? And if it is, if that's the case, will I be sinning if I call the police on my husband? Or I would hear imams respond to their questions by saying, well, what did you do wrong? You know, why did he hit you? Instead of saying it's never acceptable for him to hit you. And they would say to husbands, you know, you're hitting her for the wrong reason. You're not supposed to hit her. The prophet never hit his wives. Like, it's better if you don't hit your wives. But there was never a categorical rejection to saying that this is an un-Islamic practice. Absolutely, you cannot hit your wives. And that really troubled me. And so when I was, and I'm searching for these alternative interpretations, and I didn't really encounter any until I was doing my master's at the University of Toronto. It was a collaborative master's with Near Eastern Civilizations and Women's Studies. And for the first time, I think it was Pamela Clausen's class that I was taking on religious feminisms, I encountered the work of Muslim feminists. Muslim women like Amina Wadud and Asma Barlas and Ziba Mir Husseini, who were writing for and advocating for Muslim women's rights. And they were making an argument for an egalitarian vision of Islam. And in proposing this egalitarian vision of Islam, they had to deal with, you know, thorny issues within Islam. And of course, one of the issues it dealt with was this verse. And they offered nonviolent ways to read this verse. in a way that, you know, did not condone violence against women and even did not privilege husbands over wives.
So if I can interrupt for a second, is this attention to this particular verse and it being addressed by the Muslim feminists something that happened in the last decade or two decades? Is it new?
Yes.
In the sense that people, women in particular, are speaking out against this.
Right. So absolutely. Muslim women for the first time in Muslim history are part of the production of knowledge. I mean, Ziba Mir Husseini has this thing. She says they're part of the production of knowledge for the first time in history. And it's a really important point because for the first time they're speaking religiously and authoritatively. And what was interesting to me was, you know, to backtrack for a second and actually tell you what this verse says. The verse says, and the standard translation that I encountered says, that husbands are in authority over wives. So you know, men are in authority over women because God has preferred some over others and because they spend of their wealth. Righteous women are obedient and guard in their husband's absence what God would have them guard. As for those women on whose part you fear disobedience or disloyalty or ill conduct, the Arabic word is nushuz, admonish them, abandon them in bed, and hit them. If they obey you, do not seek a means against them. So it's a very provocative verse, and you can imagine that this is a verse that Muslim feminists have to deal with. And so Muslim feminists offer nonviolent ways to read this verse. For example, they said, you know, the opening line that men are in authority over women was a descriptive statement of 7th century Arabia when this verse was revealed. It was not meant to be a normative statement about how things should be forever and ever. It was really about how things were. And that now this has changed because the sentence goes on to say because they spend of their wealth. And in fact, men are not the sole breadwinners anymore of families. So this is not a normative statement. And then they say, you know, righteous women are obedient to God. There's no problem there. Whereas in the pre-colonial period, it turns out that scholars always interpreted that hierarchically, that righteous women were obedient to God and their husbands. And then the verse goes on to say, as for those women on whose part you fear nushuz. So Muslim feminists offered many different interpretations for this, but they basically did never interpret it as disobedience. They say, as for those women on whose part you fear sexual disloyalty or like something's wrong in the marriage that needs to be fixed, you should engage in mutual consultation. So that's how they interpret the admonishment. And then you should try separation. And if separation doesn't work, then you should walk away from the marriage. Alternatively, another way to translate the same word, daraba, wadribuhunna, which is the Arabic word for hit them, which is how it's been described, it can also mean have makeup sex. So like if the separation works, you can have makeup sex. So like there's different ways to read it. And what I was really stunned by when I encountered these interpretations was not only that they existed, but that I had never heard of them before. Like, why weren't Muslims holding on to these interpretations with both hands and just running with it? Because what a great gift to the community.
Now, were men conscious of these contradictions and distinct interpretations and trying to seek some clarification as well? Or is it just really beginning to happen among the women?
So the works that I encountered were works by Muslim women, Muslim feminists. But, you know, the thing is, I do think that Muslim men were also struggling with this verse. And I think their discomfort was really expressed when I would ask them about this verse. They would try to lighten the meaning of the verse or make it sound not as bad. And they would try to make it, you know, like they would try to not allow it to condone violence without really going all the way. So I think they were also struggling. Like, they were very uncomfortable with this verse. They weren't just like, no, yeah, it says you can hit your wife and that's it. Like, nobody ever said that to me either. So that was important. So I got really interested in this issue of authority. Like, why did these feminists not have authority within the community? Why weren't Muslims running with this verse? And so I decided to do, from when I got to my doctoral work, I decided to do a survey of how Muslims treat this verse in the pre-colonial period. So the book, basically, is an intellectual history of how Muslim scholars and activists talk about this verse from the 9th century to the 16th century and in Arabic. All of the sources are Arabic. The printed sources in Arabic. I look at Quran commentaries and Islamic jurisprudence. So I look at the ways that Muslim scholars comment on this verse, and like in commentaries where they go verse by verse and explain every single verse. And then how was this verse, like did it have any bearing legally? What bearing did it have for Islamic law? And then I look in the modern period, I look in the 20th and 21st centuries to mitigate the effects of colonialism, which did fundamentally change the discourse around gender.
So are there geographical distinctions and differences?
Right. Okay, so that's a good question. So in the pre-modern period, I only look at Arabic printed sources because Arabic was the language of the scholarly elite. So if you were a scholar writing in Spain or in China or in Persia or in the Middle East, you would be writing in Arabic. And so this allowed, looking at Arabic sources that were printed, allowed for vast geographic difference, looking at over a time period, but it was restricted by the language. So I look only at Arabic sources. And in the modern period, in the contemporary period, or what I call the post-colonial period in the book, I look at sources in Arabic, Urdu, and English. And the reason I chose those sources was because Arabic is still the language of the scholarly elite in the Muslim world. English is the new global language. And Urdu is spoken or understood by 500 million people, making it the largest Islamic hate language. So it gives us a good geographic diversity, although, of course, it's still restricted by the languages.
So I want to know what surprised you.
So two things surprised me. One was that in the pre-colonial period, Muslim scholars across the board endorsed the right or assumed the right of husbands to hit their wives as a basic marital right, both in the Quran commentaries and in the works of jurisprudence. So there was not a single scholar that said, no, actually, this is not what this verse means. And it would be really unjust if it meant this. So nobody says that. And, you know, my surprise might be born out of my naivete, but there it is. In the modern period, though, in the post-colonial period, there is much more diversity around this verse. There are some Muslims that are arguing for the verse in a, like, offering traditional interpretations of this verse. But there are many, many Muslims who are deeply troubled by the pre-colonial interpretation of the verse, and they're finding new ways to interpret it so that it neither privileges husbands over wives in marriage, and it certainly does not give them disciplinary privileges, and it does not allow them to hit their wives. And so what I was surprised to find was that the contemporary Muslim conversation was so diverse and really enriched. If we think of the Islamic tradition as stopping at colonialism, then when it comes to this issue anyways, the tradition is flat and monolithic and really stagnant. But if we expand the definition of the Islamic tradition to include the voices that speak in the 20th and 21st centuries, then we enrich that tradition dramatically and we allow much more diversity of opinion.
I think it's pretty fascinating that it's a text that initiates all of the research, the thinking, the interpretation, the public discussion.
Right.
But it's one text that has done it. Were you surprised by that?
Or
you always felt that it was so problematic,
it
had to be understood.
Right. It always stood out to me, right? I mean, the Quran is a text that Muslims all over the world read. There's like 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, and they all engage with this text that don't all know what it means. But for those that read it, it becomes, you know, and what's interesting is in the pre-colonial period, this text wasn't really problematized, right? Like, Muslim scholars were not troubled by this text. They were like, okay, you know, this fulfills our expectation of how husbands and wives should relate to each other, and they were really okay with it, given that they belonged to a patriarchal, social, and historical context. In the post-colonial period, when Muslims are advocating for a gender-equal vision of Islam, suddenly this text becomes much more controversial or problematic, where it's like a puzzle that needs to be worked through. It's a knot that needs to be untangled. And so suddenly it takes center stage in the conversation about, you know, who Muslims are, what do they believe in about Islam, what kind of an Islam do they believe in, what sort of a God do Muslims believe in?
Well, I also know you've extended this to the general public in terms of the op-ed piece you recently did for the Globe and Mail, and I do want to repeat the headline for it. Does the Quran allow wife beating? Not if Muslims don't want it to. What prompted you to go to a newspaper to discuss this?
So that's a great question. And I think I wanted to share this with the general public because I think that my concerns around this verse are not unique. They reflect a conversation that is happening in the Muslim world that is deeply painful, but also deeply personal to many Muslims. I mean, this is research that came out of a personal experience of, you know, encountering this verse as a believer and trying to figure out how to be a believer and also, like, believe in gender equality. But it also is something that I encountered in many mosques, in many conversations with Muslims throughout the Muslim world and in the Western world. I knew for a fact that I was not the only one that had these concerns or felt this way. And I wanted to open up the conversation and allow Muslims to participate in it more broadly. And I also, I think, want to help Muslims make a choice, like sort of recognize their agency in knowing that they don't have to follow an interpretation of this verse that they don't want to, that there are other options available to them and they can actually, like, I don't want people to have to do, you know, a master's or a PhD and, you know, encounter these Muslim feminists, like, you know, through the, like I want them to have more ready access to them. And finally, I want Muslims to be able to hold their leaders accountable for the interpretations that they choose and the interpretations that they preach. The fact is that Muslims are making a choice when they pick one interpretation over another. So they need to be aware of the agency that they have and also the responsibility that they have as a result.
Was the paper receptive to this idea?
Was the...
The paper, the Globe and Mail.
They were. They were extremely supportive. And it's gotten, I think, over 2,000 shares since it went up. So I think people are interested in this topic.
I think it's marvelous. I thought the column was very clear and persuasive and pointed. And that's what they should be. And I think you did a wonderful job with that.
Thank you so much.
Now, I know another piece that you wrote not so long ago was simply entitled Women. And it appeared in the Encyclopedia of Islamic Political Thought. What did you say in that particular piece? And does it relate to your other thoughts on Islam and the status of women?
That's a good question. I wrote that piece a couple of years ago. You're putting me on the spot. No, it's a good. I really enjoyed writing that piece, actually, because it was. I was asked to write that piece. It was one of 15 core entries in that journal, in that encyclopedia, and so it was going to be a big entry. And it was going to. They were really concerned about what it would look like. You know, obviously, it's a political issue, and I wanted to talk about the way that Muslim women have been involved in political thought in Muslim history, starting from the Prophet's generation throughout the centuries until the present day. And especially put that in, like, that history is especially important because in the post-colonial period, Muslims, but especially Muslim women, have become highly politicized. And so I wanted my readers to sort of recognize that although Islam has originated in a patriarchal, social, and historical context, the fact of the matter is that Muslim women have had prominent political roles in Islam and in Islamic history from the 7th century onward. They've always been vocal participants and politically active at the level of being judges and rulers and leading wars and being involved in politics in all sorts of ways. So that's what that I think that piece was about. And I ended with, you know, discussing the way Muslim women have become politicized in the modern world and thinking, especially reflecting on the role of Afghan women in the war in Afghanistan, the way that they were portrayed by the Taliban were sort of like trying to save Muslim their women from the West and putting them in burqas, and the Muslim and you know Laura Bush said that they were going into Afghanistan because they wanted to save these same women, but you know the women were just pawns in this larger war geopolitical struggle between the U.S. and Afghanistan.
Is the time right to think or write a kind of feminist history of women and Islam?
That's a really great idea. I think that one of the challenges that it is at the right time. That would be a welcome project. It would be a very challenging thing to do. But it would also be very exciting because it doesn't take a ton of research to know that right immediately that Muslim women have been active in Muslim history. So that would be an amazing project.
It seems like things are happening and a kind of opening up mm-hmm. is occurring. But right. Now can it be, no pun intended, translated into a proper kind of revisionist history?
Right.
Because I think you're absolutely right. Most people, Muslims and non-Muslims, are simply unaware mm-hmm. of this kind of tradition, this
right.
kind of action.
Right.
You know, yes, people are conscious of contemporary problems, and you've done a wonderful job in articulating that. But
right.
the long history
mm-hmm.
strikes me as still obscure.
Right. And some people have begun to do, you know, some work that talks about Muslim women in Muslim history, like Judith Tucker has some work on this, and Laurie Silvers has written about Sufi Muslim women. And so people have begun doing work on it, but I love the idea of writing a history, a feminist history of Islam. That's great.
All right. I expect now to get you working on this. I want to know about students in the classroom when you address some of these issues, which I presume you do. What's the reaction of the students? Engaged, disengaged, embarrassed, concerned?
So the students that take my course are students that are really interested in asking the hard questions about Islam. So whether they're a Muslim or not, they're already there. And, you know, in the first class in each of my courses, I make it very clear that when I'm teaching that, you know, in the religious studies classes, I make it very clear that we are doing this is an academic study of religion. So the kinds of questions and conversations that we're going to be having in the classroom are very unlike the ones that they might encounter in a mosque, for example. So the ones that stick around are very engaged, and I usually don't bring up this topic until later on in the semester, my own specialization, because it's, you know, it's sensitive for all sorts of reasons. In both my gender studies classes as well as my religious studies classes. But in both cases, my students it depends on which class I'm teaching in particular, but in general, they're extremely engaged. They're extremely thoughtful. You know, I taught this gender and Islamic law course last year, which was cross-listed with the law school. And so it was a religious studies law school students. And it was just an amazing experience. And there were these, you know, there were some students, like some Muslim male students who started out the class by being like, well, you know, like they really didn't feel like the verse was like really the biggest problem they'd ever encountered. And then while we were reading pre-modern legal texts about it, and I have done great, like, long translations of them. And so I was reading them translations. This one student who sort of started out being like, what's so bad about this verse? I looked over at him and he had his head in his hands. Like he was embarrassed. But, you know, to his credit, he stuck with it and he struggled and he came out holding very different views at the end of the course. So I really enjoy sharing my research with my students.
I think it's critical. And I think that you do spark them and provoke them, mm-hmm. which is what I believe should really happen. Right. And it's the exchange. Right.
Right,
and
exactly.
It's the, you know, the root of the word education means to raise up. And mm-hmm. this is exactly what's going on.
And the most important thing for me in that in these classes is to show that Muslims don't speak with one voice. I mean, you think it would be an obvious fact, but it's not. And so it's about really showing them the performance of intra-Muslim conversation, where Muslims are talking and fighting and arguing with each other about, and, you know, and the stakes are really high for them, and they don't agree on what this text means.
So I have to ask you, what direction do you hope to take your work next?
That's a question everybody asks me now. And I want to just sort of like not do anything for a while. But obviously, I'm an academic, so I'm not doing that. I'm doing a policy piece right now on domestic violence laws in the United Arab Emirates. And I'm moving into policy a little bit. But I'm also making a religious argument for criminalizing domestic violence. I'm also looking at the ways that Muhammad's example can be used to advocate for a feminist understanding of Islamic law, but also exploring the ways that his practice can be a hurdle to that. So, for example, in the case of the minimum marriage age in Yemen, Yemen had a minimum marriage age, but then it was revoked. It was removed because religious scholars in particular made a strong argument that having a minimum marriage age was an insult to the Prophet, because the Prophet married a woman when she was between 6 and 9 years old named Aisha. And so... Muslim scholars are also making the argument in Yemen that his behavior was exceptional and not exemplary in this case, and so they should have a minimum marriage age. So I'm sort of beginning to explore that a little bit more as well. The role that his practice plays in advocating for women's rights, but also the challenges that Muslim feminists face as a result of his practice.
So where do you go to do the research? Where do you locate the text? Do you travel to the Middle East? Are there reasonable libraries in North America?
Mm-hmm.
How do you access material?
Right. So I have traveled to the Middle East. And of course, that's like an important part of like thinking about what issues are important to Muslims. What are they thinking about? How are they like? What is most urgent? I mean, I'm very interested in that kind of scholarship. But in terms of libraries, we have some great libraries in North America. We have NYU, Princeton, Harvard have phenomenal libraries. I can access some of that stuff through ILL, interlibrary loan, which is really wonderful. But when you want to look through hundreds of sources, it's just easier to go down to another library and check it out. So some of it's archival work. Some of it is, you know, I'm beginning to do much more, a little bit more contemporary work. And so I get to actually, you know, interact with people in person and over the internet. I was just in Morocco at a consultative meeting with the Moroccan government and a women's advocacy group named Musawa, which means equality. It was a consultative meeting about thinking about ways to increase, to make family law more gender egalitarian in Muslim majority countries. So how to make a religious argument to do that? Because religious scholars are the primary people that oppose gender equal family law are usually Muslim scholars as well. So sort of like tackling their arguments from a religious perspective. And so sometimes I actually attend these meetings and these conferences and I'm there in person. Other times I'm reading people's works and reading on the internet, or sometimes I'm in libraries.
Actual library. That's fantastic. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. I'm so pleased that you could join us today. So I'd like to thank Ayesha Chaudhry from the Department of Classical Near Eastern Religious Studies. She's also, as I said earlier, a member of the Institute for Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice. And stay tuned for further shows dealing with UBC and the arts. Thank you again.
Thank